Good morning, Marbleites. Oh, and you folks out there in live stream land, it is cold here in New York, as I think I have said from time to time before. It is colder than Christian charity. And you know how cold that can be. But we are warm in here, and we have warm hearts, and we're glad to be here, and I'm glad to see you here. And today, we're going to talk about, we're in the Gospel of John right now. We're going to be in the second chapter, and it's got a lot of interesting things in here. First, we're going to talk about Nathanael under the fig tree. It's the very tail end. We won't really read it, but it's the tail end of the first chapter. And in the first chapter, remember, we had that long hymn. And then we had John the Baptist identifying Jesus as the Lamb of God. And then the last thing we see is Philip introduces him to Nathanael. Jesus sees Nathanael coming and he says, "Here truly is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Now apparently he didn't know Nathanael that we know. But I wonder why he says, "Here is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Remember that when we met Jacob back in the book of Genesis, remember that Jacob was one of these people who got renamed, that his name had been Jacob, and he gets renamed Israel. And so that Israel becomes, Israel and Jacob are the same person, but then renaming Jacob, we're understanding that the whole of Israel is the children of Jacob, and that Israel is kind of a group noun for all the people. Also, we remember, though, that Jacob was a trickster. Remember that he's the one who tricked Esau, and that they had a lot of arguments about each other, and that there were times when Jacob was scared of Esau because of what he'd done to him. When Jacob talks about Nathanael being an Israelite in whom there is no deceit, here's how this goes. "Here comes an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." It's chapter 1, verse 47. Nathanael asked him, "Where did you get to know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." And Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God." But why? Because you saw him under the fig tree? That seems odd. And Jesus says, "Do you believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." Now, where did we see angels ascending and descending? That was also in the book of Genesis, remember? Remember that Jacob lay down and took a nap and had a dream, and he saw a ladder joining heaven and earth and angels going up and down on it. Here, Jesus describes himself as the ladder, upon whom angels go up and down between heaven and earth, and upon whom we also, the ladder joining heaven and earth, and Jesus is the one joining heaven and earth. So when he's talking to Nathanael as an Israelite in whom there is no guile, he's also talking about a new Israel in whom there's not going to be any guile, in whom there's going to be, they're going to see truly, and upon him, upon Jesus, heaven and earth will be joined. So that's how we end chapter 1. Then we start chapter 2, and let's do it. Who wants to read verses 1 through 11 of chapter 2 in the Gospel of John? Some wonderful reader we're going to hear. Q, go ahead. But wait for the mic so that the live streamers can hear you. Just go ahead. There's no wrong translation. They're just different ones.
"On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, 'They have no more wine.' "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him.
Good. Okay. So that's usually referred to as Jesus' first miracle. And we think it's interesting because his first miracle happened at a wedding. And it's not it's not like healing somebody. And it's not like, say, stilling the sea, or it's not a nature miracle. It's not raising somebody from the dead. That's all going to come later. But this first miracle happens in a social situation. It's the first of what are kind of known as the seven signs in the Gospel of John. And I'll give you a list of them, just in case you're ever interested in looking the rest of them up. Changing the water into the wine is the first one. Healing somebody's son, a royal official's son in Capernaum, that's in John 4, is the second one. Healing the paralytic at Bethesda in John 5 is the third one. Feeding the 5,000 in John 6 is the fourth one. Walking on water, also in 6, is the fifth one. Healing a man who was blind from birth is the sixth one. And raising Lazarus from the dead is the seventh one. So in John, there are seven of what John calls signs. And they range from this one at a wedding reception to something actually raising somebody from the dead. Seven signs of the new creation, the reordering of things. Water becomes wine. The sick are healed. The hungry are fed. The earth itself, the raging sea, is tamed. And finally, even the dead are raised. Seven important signs in the Gospel of John. So let's take a look. You know what's interesting? In the Gospel of John, Mary is not named. You know, we said last week there's no birth narrative in the Gospel of John. We just meet Jesus for the first time as an adult. But we meet his mother, too, and she's mentioned but not named. Nor is Joseph. Mary and Joseph are not, Joseph isn't listed at all, but Mary appears, but has no name. But she is honored. She was invited specially, separately to this wedding. The mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited. His mother speaks to him. And points out that there's no wine. And he answers, "Woman, what concern is that to you and me?" Now that seems rude to us. Some translations say, "Dear woman." Does yours say that, Q? Does he call her just woman or dear woman?
Dear woman.
Dear woman. Not always in English translations, but in that one. Where the word dear is not used, it suggests that the translator thinks that he's speaking rather brusquely to her. And I have to say, that seems a little brusque. What concern is that to you and to me? What business is that of us? It's not exactly the way you would talk to your mother, maybe. And what I've often thought is that in every occasion in the Gospels upon which we see Jesus talking to his mother, it's a little bit like that. Jesus going to the temple and teaching the elders does not appear when he's 12 years old. That doesn't appear in the Gospel of John. But when it does appear in the other Gospels, he's a little cheeky with her, and it just makes you wonder about that. Yes, sir. We're going to get you on the mic so that the people at home can hear you.
I thought that if the next thing she says to the servants, do whatever he tells you, she must have been like the maid of honor or something like that. Because why should we?
She was certainly a one who could give
orders,
some instructions to the servants and they would listen. Also, it sounds like she was not surprised by this. However we might take what he said to her, she knows how to take him from now. I guess she's known what he could do now for a long time. And so she just says, okay, sit tight. You're about to see something really interesting.
And the other thing is that it's the only commandment that she gives in the Bible.
Yeah, we don't have her telling anybody anything really to do, but she does here in the Gospel of John. So that suggests some importance and honor to her. And I'm going to argue in a little while that what we don't see in the Gospel of John is what we see in some of the other Gospels is a certain hostility to family. Remember that in some others, they leave their dad in the fishing boat, and some others, if you don't hate your mother and your father, you can't follow me. We don't see that in the Gospel of John. There seems to be a kind of a friendliness toward family, and that would be suggested by the fact that this miracle happens at a wedding, which is a happy occasion. Later on, the gospel, after Jesus, but not too long after, Paul is going to think, well, marriage really isn't a very good thing at all, and you're better off if you don't. But Jesus apparently doesn't think that. He's happy to go to a wedding, and he wants the wedding to go well. Marilyn, we need to get you on the mic.
Why do you think he would talk to his mother like that?
Well, part of it is the translator, and so, we don't really know, and that some of the English translations translate that word that we have woman as more respectfully dear woman suggests that there was a way to, for instance, if we had the difference between woman and lady, we would say, well, lady's a little more respectful. It's kind of like that. It's kind of like that. But what has this to do with us does sound a little uppity. Still, Mary does not seem to take it that way. She already knows what he can do. Who knows? Well, what that childhood must have been like, I don't know. And she was figuring him out over the years. But by this time, when he's in his 30s, she knows very well what he can do, and so she says, okay, well, do whatever he tells you, and he does. Somebody else had a hand up, am I right? Oh, okay, Stan.
What if he's asking her, not in a disrespectful way, but like, do you have a suggestion of what I might do it, like inviting her to
That's
ask him to perform the miracle?
That's interesting.
And also, in another class, I heard that when you're referred to as a woman, it in those days meant honored lady.
Yeah, yeah.
So that
what this particular translation suggests and what the Greek word might. It doesn't sound as disrespectful to them as it might to us. Yeah. So they have jars standing there. What are they for? They're for washing the dishes. They're for ceremonial purification. You have a lot of responsibilities as a Jewish cook and a Jewish host. You have to wash dishes before using them. You have to wash them after. There are prayers about cleansing dishes, and these very large jars. There is a church in a town that some people think is Cana. We don't really know where Cana was. It's in Galilee, but where exactly? There are a couple towns that are nominated, and in one of these towns there is a church, and in the church are two enormous stone jars, which are said to be two of the six jars that were there. Where are they? Well, I don't know. I wasn't there. But these traditions happen all over in churches in the ancient Near East, that you go to one and hear this. This is the such and such that Jesus used on such and such a day. Who are we to say no? It's tradition, and it is instructive for the people who live there. So he sees these jars. They are for water. They're going to be filled with water, but they aren't yet. They're empty. And so the servants pour the water in, and as soon as the water lands there, it has become wine. They have a wine steward. It's wonderful. There's a wonderful Giotto painting of this moment. Giotto is kind of the father of the Italian Renaissance. And in the Scrivania Chapel in Padua, there's a wonderful set of paintings of the life of Christ. And in one of them is this miracle. And the wine steward is one of my favorite people in art because, to my knowledge, he is the first fat person in Western art. He's quite rotund, and he's there among his jars with his sommelier's cup, tasting the wine, ready to be impressed by how wonderful it is. The steward calls the bridegroom and says, wow, this is really something. And most people don't do that. Now, when you have a party, do you serve the cheap stuff later when they don't know what they're drinking? Well, apparently that was one of the things. I guess you might do that. I have known of people who poured cheap stuff into the bottles that used to hold expensive stuff. But apparently one of the things people did was to serve cheap wine later when everybody was too drunk to know. Interesting that this wine is wine and is linked to drunkenness in people's imaginations. Which calls the whole tradition of Christian teetotaling into question. A lot of Christians think it's unchristian to drink alcohol. Apparently, Jesus does not think so. A fair number of people have gone to great lengths to say, oh, no, the wine that they had wasn't wine. Well, I don't know. I wasn't there. And if chemistry is your thing, knock yourself out on that. But here, it seems to be wine that has alcohol in it. And Jesus did this, it says, the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Well, now we've already heard Jesus question too ready a belief on the basis of miracles with Nathanael. Nathanael was shocked that Jesus saw him under the fig tree. And Jesus says, well, as miracles go, that isn't much, so stay tuned. Here the disciples seem to be easily impressed. Granted, it's a big deal, and it's a colorful miracle. But in terms of importance in people's lives, we're gonna see more. Jesus says we're gonna see more. So he went down to Capernaum with his mother, his brothers, and his disciples, and they remained there a few days. So in the Gospel of John, in general, the Jesus that we meet is very self-confident. He, in a way, is above people's experience. He is so kind of like a superman, not one to whom limitations of any kind apply. Other gospel writers in some ways want to demonstrate this by showing him to be sort of hostile to family relationships, and we've seen this a few times. One guy says, well, wait, let me go bury my father first. Remember that one? And Jesus says, oh, let the dead bury their own dead. Well, that would be harsh if you'd just lost your father. We saw the sons of Zebedee, they're helping their father in the boat, and Jesus says, follow me, and they go, and there's a poor old Zebedee without four hands to help him, so what about that? We hear Jesus saying, those who do not hate their mothers and fathers are unworthy to follow me. That would seem harsh to us. We sort of hate to hear that. At one point in the three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we have Jesus' mother and his brothers coming to where Jesus is speaking and trying to get him to go home. They come there, and the disciples say, your mother and your brothers are here, and they want to speak to you. And Jesus says, well, who is my mother? And who are my brothers? Those who do the will of my Father. Those are that's my family, not my family of blood. Here, it's kind of different. Although Jesus is Olympian in stature and very high, in comparison with other human beings, although many people say, and I think it's true, that John is kind of the most dualistic of the Gospels. John has, light and darkness all the time. The world is dark and the Spirit is light. So, yeah, there's a big difference between Jesus and other people. One of the ways in which this is not true in the Gospel of John is his treatment of his own family. When they go to Capernaum, his mother and his brothers go with him. And when we know that the brothers that they describe are not just the disciples, it's not a description of how close he is with the disciples, because it's the brothers and his disciples. So his mom goes with him. His mom is in his posse of the people who go along with him. So far from sort of disdaining marriage and family and contrasting it with the spiritual life, like some people do, Jesus doesn't do that in John. And it's funny that it's that way in John, because he is so far above us in the way he's presented, his strength and his confidence and his knowledge. But of course, in John, as mighty as he is, John is the only one in which he weeps. Remember, later on we'll see, when we see the raising of Lazarus, that Jesus weeps when he sees how long Lazarus has been there and that he has lost his friends. So as powerful as he is in John, he is not immune to human feeling and human attachment. Marilyn, let's get you on the mic so the live streamers can hear you.
Did I miss something? Did everybody know that this man turned water into wine?
Well, the wine steward knows it. The bridegroom knows it. The disciples know it. They do know that they've run out of wine. And they do know that suddenly there's wine. And they know that nobody went out to the liquor store. So I guess the company does know. We don't hear about the jubilation that ensued on the part of anybody but the wine steward. And it's interesting that the bridegroom appears to be the host. For us, usually the bride's parents give the party. Custom in the ancient Near East is different. But in any case, it would ordinarily be the parents of both parties who would give this celebration, even in the ancient Near East. So this bridegroom, Jesus is often called the bridegroom in our tradition. So this bridegroom is kind of maybe in contrast to another bridegroom who is the one that has done this miracle. So in the Episcopal wedding service, one of the things we say is that Jesus consecrated the state of marriage in Genesis when he endows the first human being with a partner, but also in his wedding and first miracle at a wedding. What I like about the marriage of Cana is that it consecrates daily life. That daily life, like a wedding, like all of the occasions that we have, human life, the things that human beings do, they can be transformed and be spiritual experiences as well. Spiritual does not have to mean, monastic or disconnected from our lives. Our lives are spiritual lives, and everything that we do can be transformed. Everything that you do can be a prayer if you want it to be. And so for those of us, you might say, well, I didn't become a nun, I didn't become a monk, and so I have a secular life, and we have a secular life. But even our secular life, it can be consecrated to Jesus if we want to do that. And we have a choice about how we will manage and conduct ourselves wherever we are. And we transform the world by doing that. And doesn't matter how important we are or are not, we're all important. So I think one of the things that we can say about the wedding of Cana of Galilee is that it's about the transformation of the earthly into the heavenly. And when Jesus talks right before it about going up and down between heaven and earth, well, that's what this is. What could be more earthly than a wedding in which two people are going to get married? And in the ancient Near East, that's all about hoping to have children and keeping the earth going. But it's linked to heaven. Let's continue. We're going to, right from this event, we go into the cleansing of the temple. Let's read verses 13 to the end of chapter 2. Who wants to read? Okay, sir, look at that. He's on his machine. This is, we have some very elderly millennials here, and this man is on his iPhone, people in live stream land. Just in case you don't think we're hip, we are.
And the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem and found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. And when he made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple and the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overthrew the tables. He said unto them that sold doves, take these things hence, make not my Father's house an house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it was written, the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. Then answered the Jews and said unto him, what sign shewest thou unto us, seeing that thou dost these things? Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? But he spake of the temple of his body. When therefore he was risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this unto them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, in the feast day, many believed in his name when they saw the miracles which he did. But Jesus did not commit himself unto them, because he knew all men, and needed not that any should testify of man, for he knew that was in man.
Thank you. They see the signs and they believe. Jesus himself, as we've seen him do in other gospels, distances himself a little bit from the signs. He says, yes, the signs are important and good, but don't rely on them only. So he doesn't entrust himself totally to them, even though the signs have made them believe. Notice that this is in the Passover. But it's not the Passover we're talking about later on when he dies. This is earlier on in his ministry. Contrast his treatment of what's going on in the temple. And what is the temple? The temple is the spiritual place. The temple is where you go to be spiritual. You don't go to a wedding reception to be spiritual. You go there to have a good time. The temple is where you go to meet God. But it's interesting. He transforms the wedding reception, where you just go for a good time with your friends. That's the spiritual place. And the temple, where they're preparing animals for the sacrifice, he trashes that. So we're seeing Jesus say, the temple and holy is holy, and everything that is visibly, obviously spiritual is that. But look, I'm going to take that and I'm going to flip it. And I'm going to take an ordinary situation like a wedding reception and a holy situation like happens in the temple, and I'm going to switch them. And I'm going to show you what we see, what I showed Nathaniel. He tells Nathaniel at the end of the first chapter, you're going to see heaven opened and the angel of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Heaven is going to be joined to earth, and earth is going to be joined to heaven. A wonderful poet from the 16th century, Robert Southwell, describes it this way, that Jesus, lifts earth to heaven and stoops heaven to earth. So heaven stoops in Jesus, and we rise and we meet in Jesus. So the great divide that we certainly see in the Gospel of John between light and darkness, heaven and earth, also in the Gospel of John, we see joined. That's what Jesus is. He joins us with heaven and destroys the gulf that we have erected between the spiritual and the ordinary. If we look at it this way, there is no ordinary. Everything is and can be spiritual. God has created everything, and at the very beginning of, remember in the hymn that we read at the very beginning of the gospel, he says, in him all things came to being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. So for John, everything is part of God. There's no division. And that's just funny because most people would say, you know, golly, the division between spiritual and earthly is huge in John. And in one way it is, but then in another way it isn't at all. We had a comment here. Let's get the mic on her so that the live streamers can hear. Are you live streamers still awake? I see you over there in Iowa. Come on now, wake up.
Of course, he says there always be focused. Mm-hmm. You must always be focusing whatever place where you are, whether mm-hmm. it's, and you're saying the same thing, but yeah. to me it just highlights yeah. it that we must always be focused wherever we are.
And you can't count on, you know, just because you're in the temple, just because you're in the church doesn't
That's
mean
right.
you're focused. We all know that. Whose mind has not wandered? Mine has. And just because I was in the church doesn't make me a Christian. Somebody said, yeah, you know, going to church doesn't make you a Christian because being in a garage does not make you a car.
That's right. Yeah.
I didn't make that up. It's a good one, though. We are part of transforming the quotidian, that means the daily, into the holy. We can do that. And we can also not do that. And then if we don't do that, we're just kind of left, oh, well, one thing after another, and then you die.
And of course, even in your relationships, mm-hmm. you must be focused on God.
Yeah, yeah. And Jesus, mother and his brothers come along with him on his mission. They go with him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples. And at this miracle in Cana, his mother and his brothers are there. So the hostility that we see to kind of everyday life, you know, in a lot of the history of the church, we know that celibacy was very important in later centuries, but not right away. And even, you know, in the church as it evolved in the medieval period, the priests were married. So, and, you know, that's a controversy now within the Roman Catholic Church. Should they be married or not? A lot of people think they should. And, of course, it'll be hard for that to happen. On the other hand, in the Roman Catholic Church, it could happen with a stroke of a pen. So you never know. You never know. So stay tuned. So at the end of the chapter, we have this overturning the tables at the temple. We've talked before about this. The fact that they were buying and selling in the temple isn't really the problem. They had to do that because the temple has special coins. It's like when you go to a new country, you have to change your money. Well, to go into the temple and make a sacrifice, buy the animals that you know are pure for sacrifice, you need temple coins. So that all was not the problem. It wasn't that they were buying and selling, it's their attitude, it's their focus. Just as you were saying, they're doing a holy thing, but they've long ago forgotten why they're doing a holy thing. They've lost their focus. And he strikes out at it in a violent way. Let's take a look at verse 9. The Jews protest. Oh, and when John talks about the Jews, which he does a lot, which is why anti-Semites have used the Gospel of John to criticize and even kill Jews. But when John talks about the Jews, he's writing to Jews. He's contrasting Jews with Romans, John is a Jew, Jesus is a Jew, and the other Jews are protesting to him on the basis of their Jewishness. Hey, wait a minute, you're a Jew. What are you doing in the temple breaking up the furniture? That's what the Jews are saying to him. They're all Jews, and they are saying, what gives? What are you doing? Jesus says in verse 19, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Now he's standing in the temple. And of course, by the time the Gospel of John is written, the temple has been destroyed. So Jesus and his disciples, well, at least his disciples, don't know that the temple's going to be destroyed. But John writing does, and everybody reading John, they know that this happened, in 70 AD. And John's writing, 85, 90. And so, so when Jesus talks about destroy this temple, many people remember that that happened. Many people who read this and hear it remember that that happened, and some of them maybe were there. But it goes on, he was speaking of the temple of his body. And then they talk about, and then they remembered that he rose on the third day. So what do we think about this? Was he talking about his own body? That's what John thinks. Or somebody who was copying John, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. They say this has been under construction for 46 years and you're going to raise it up in 3 days? So is it an allegory about his own body? Is he predicting his own resurrection? John thinks so. But if it isn't, if this is the John's editorial remark or the editorial remark of a scribe, he was talking about his own body, that this is a kind of an addition to it. If Jesus is actually talking about the temple, when he talks about this destruction, and he is standing in the temple, he certainly is predicting the destruction of the temple. He would be talking about, even the temple is something you can't depend on. The relationship between you and God is what you can depend on. The integrity and the genuineness of your connection with God that's supposed to happen with you in the temple. The temple is supposed to bring you closer to God. If it isn't, it can be destroyed. And even if it is destroyed, and by the time John is writing, it has been, it can be raised up in a different form. You're not going to have a temple anymore, but you will still have yourselves. You will still have the community. The temple, in figurative terms, in symbolic terms, even if the structure is gone, can still exist in the community of Christ. So John thinks he's talking about the temple of his own body, but he may also be talking about the temple of the church, the community of the church of God, the people themselves, who even when everything appears to be lost, can be transformed. Just like when all the wine ran out and water was transformed. So two separate events, the wedding at Cana and then this overturning of the money changers in the temple, are kind of about the same thing. When all hope is gone, or the wine, there's no more wine, God can take water and turn it into wine. And when the temple is destroyed and there's no hope at all, God can take your community and rebuild the temple, not out of stones this time, but in our own hearts. I'm trying to think of situations in which all hope has been lost. You know some in your own heart, your own life. There might have been a time in your life when everything kind of crashed and you looked around and said, now what do I do? There is nothing left. But you know what? You're still here and you didn't die that time. I don't know what it was in your life, but you're here. So whatever happened, God rebuilt and here you are. And so when all is lost, it turns out for us all is not really lost. Maybe all is never really lost. Maybe as long as we are alive, there is always hope. And even when we're not, we affirm, or we wouldn't be here on a Sunday morning, that even when this life ends, all hope is not lost by any means, because we have hope, as Jesus had hope, in the temple of his own body, that he is raised after 3 days. Marilyn, we had a remark here. Let's give her the mic.
I have not seen this, but this morning on Channel 2, they talking about all that's lost and found, the Green Book. And it seems as though this minister in 1936 created the book where they weren't called African Americans, they were black or Negroes, could go to be safe. Yeah. And the entire thing was so beautiful. So I haven't seen it. It's something that I think should be seen, because
I was all grown up before I even heard about the Green Book. But every black person knew about the Green Book. And if you wanted to travel anywhere in the United States, you had to have one. Do anybody remember it? Do you remember that, Patricia?
Well, I don't think every black person knew. They didn't. But those who traveled.
Yeah, if you travel, if you wanted to drive somewhere.
You know, every black person did not know. But many people did travel. Yeah. And those who traveled, and especially people in the arts.
Yeah.
When they traveled and they had to go south.
Where are you going to stay in a hotel?
There was no place to stay. Mm-hmm. And they had to have these places. Mm-hmm. I remember as a little girl when we traveled in our automobile, we didn't really go down far south, but you would see signs when you got in a certain area. And we just, everybody had friends.
Yeah.
And that was your hotel.
But you did have to plan ahead. You had to plan ahead.
Yeah.
In a way that would be so surprising to young people today if you told them about it. That's why the Green Book is a great movie for
it's
people
like
to see.
It's like the bed and breakfast situation that we have today.
Yeah.
That's really what it was like.
Let's get the mic on you.
Very interesting that the Green Book and the other, I don't go to the movies that much, but there's another film where the chauffeur has to take the place of the pianist. And the pianist has to take the place of the chauffeur in order for the pianist.
Because a white man is not supposed to be driving
that's
a black man around.
That's right. And it's interesting that these two films come out at the same time. You know, it's
I knew about this to my reading class. Someone brought it up.
Yeah.
A lot of people like myself didn't know.
Well, some of us don't either. They used to have something called the brown bag, certain colors of African Americans were more acceptable than others. If you were, yeah, they would take a bag and even in some churches, the lighter ones were going and the darker ones
Isn't
were
that
not.
Something
and so we have all these symbols, and I think in John he has a symbols, everyday symbols that people knew about.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the reality of the event, but the symbols of the things
not,
that
not
people
the literal,
know about.
So much as what it could
it
mean.
Stands for,
some of which might be lost to us, but we can kind of crawl in there and recapture some of it. Okay, well, I think it's going to be time for us to go up and listen to Ken to give us the grace notes. I wonder what we should sing. What? Oh, of course, we talked about Jacob's Ladder, so let's do it. We are climbing Jacob's ladder, we are climbing. Jacob's ladder, we are climbing. Jacob's ladder, soldiers of the cross. You know, somebody's going to hire us because we're so good. Y'all have a wonderful week. You live streamers, behave yourselves, and we'll see you next week.